You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the complex world of enterprise identity, securing legacy web apps at scale can be daunting. Strata Identity makes it simple. With Strata, you can effortlessly integrate non-standard apps with any identity service, like MFA or SSO, with zero coding and zero hassle. Designed by identity architects for identity architects, Strata works with every vendor, standard, and app architecture. This means your apps can now speak modern protocols and integrate seamlessly with your chosen identity services. From securing on-prem web apps to migrating away from outdated identity providers or consolidating them, Strata helps you keep your complex access policies as you modernize your identity infrastructure and get rid of technical debt. Join leading organizations like 3M, Dallas County, and CIBC in securing your apps with Strata. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your identity security priorities, and receive a complimentary pair of AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Connect today at strata.io/cyberwire.
Bogus WannaCry remediation apps are hitting the Play Store, more on the complexities of WannaCry attribution, and Eternal Rock's worm may have been withdrawn by its authors. Citizen Lab finds evidence that influence operations against targets in almost 40 countries are now corrupting data. Samba gets a patch as observers fear emergence of a worm. Biometrics and impersonation, experts advise complexity. GDPR is just 1 year away, but preparation still lags. We hear from the founder of Code Like a Girl, and two noteworthy pieces of legislation are introduced into the U.S. House and Senate. I'm Dave Bittner in Baltimore with your CyberWire summary for Friday, May 26, 2017. Observers have come to regard WannaCry as the campaign that brought ransomware to the attention of ordinary individual users, as opposed to the enterprises that have suffered ransomware infestations in the past. One sign of this common touch are the bogus WannaCry remedies currently gurgling around Google's Android Play Store. Don't bite. They won't help you, and they're at best going to wind up as unwanted software. At worst, they're quite malicious. Symantec has stuck with its attribution of WannaCry to the Lazarus Group and the Lazarus Group to North Korea. Critics have emphasized the circumstantial character of the attribution and point to other bits of evidence that suggest other explanations. Flashpoint linguists think the authors of WannaCry spoke Chinese and English. They point out that this doesn't constitute attribution and isn't inconsistent with Symantec's linkage of the ransomware campaign to North Korea. It's additional circumstantial evidence that eventually may contribute to an understanding of WannaCry's origins. It's also worth noting, as Flashpoint itself emphasizes, that there's a large Chinese diaspora and an awful lot of people in many places who are fairly fluent in English. A point they do make is that it seems the authors of the ransomware pass its natural language messages through Google Translate a few times. Whether that's designed to clarify or obfuscate is unclear. It could go either way. A worm that exploited Eternal Rock's vulnerabilities and that seemed to be quietly staging future attacks may have been pulled by its creators, according to researchers at Croatia's CERT. Good news, maybe, but crying victory would be premature. Influence operations targeting the elections of France and the U.S. centered on leaked emails. Some are reckoned to have been damaging, like those affecting the U.S. Democratic National Committee, while others are thought to have had negligible effect, like the emails taken from French President Emmanuel Macron's en marche. But in those cases, there were few suggestions, even from the victims, that the stolen emails had been faked or tampered with to make the targets of the influence operations look worse than they otherwise would. That may no longer be holding true. A study by the University of Toronto's Citizen Lab finds leaked emails belonging to a Russian journalist and critic of the government were doctored to discredit the opposition. Their investigation also led them to a large phishing campaign against more than 200 high-profile targets in 39 countries. Citizen Lab is reticent about attribution, but says there's clear overlap between what they're seeing and evidence others have presented concerning Russian-affiliated threat actors. So while Mr. Podesta may have said all the stuff in those emails, in the future, caveat lector, data corruption may become as much a part of the information operations playbook as data theft currently does. Reuters reports that hackers acting apparently on behalf of the government of Vietnam are attacking Philippine targets. The larger issue is the dispute over sovereign rights in the South China Sea. This week, Samba, the popular Linux file-sharing system, was found to have a bug that's apparently endured for some 7 years. The Samba team patched it Wednesday, and users are urged to apply the patch. Samba is also a significant component in a number of network-attached storage servers. The vulnerability has drawn inevitable comparisons to WannaCry. We heard from security firm Cyfort's Nick Bilagorski. He said, quote, "Think of it as eternal blue for Linux, affecting all versions of Samba for the past 7 years since 2010, end quote. While there were few signs of exploitation in the wild, Samba has come under attack in the recent past, and Bilagorski thinks there's some risk of a new worm appearing. A proof of concept is already on Metasploit. Quote, "I think at this point attackers are already developing ways to weaponize ransomware or other malware with this," end quote. You may have seen reports that a proof-of-concept unlocking of Samsung Galaxy S8's biometrics has been achieved with a camera, a contact lens, and a printer. The demo comes courtesy of Germany's Chaos Computer Club. It's like a sophisticated version of the old gummy bear fingerprint hack, but it points out that simple biometrics aren't necessarily the panacea we might hope for in authentication and identity management. The countdown to GDPR this week entered its final year. The new European Union privacy rules take effect in mid-spring 2018. They'll affect enterprises worldwide. Studies continue to suggest that few are prepared, and time is running out. There are two new proposed bills introduced in the U.S. Congress that bear watching. A revised draft of the Active Cyber Defense Certainty Act, what people are calling the hack-back law, is out. This one includes both mandatory notification and permission for victims to recover or destroy stolen data on the attacker's systems. It seems likely that the bill will undergo further revision before it leaves the House, but U.S. representatives are clearly in a mood to consider a return to mark and reprisal. And in the U.S. Senate, the Department of Homeland Security is the intended beneficiary of the Hack DHS Act. Senators Hassan of New Hampshire and Portman of Ohio introduced the bipartisan measure today with the intention of establishing a pilot bug bounty program for the Department of Homeland Security. The senators point out that since DHS is responsible for securing the .gov domain, they have hopes that this could do for the federal government as a whole what the Hack the Pentagon has begun to do to help secure the Department of Defense. And I'm pleased to be joined once again by Malek Ben-Salem. She's the Senior Manager of Security and R&D at Accenture Labs. You wanted to share some information that Accenture has put together, sort of a vision statement about self-sustaining enterprises. What do we need to know about that?
Yeah, so doing business today in this new digital ecosystem is different, right? We notice a lot of trends that are increasing the security challenges that companies have to address. For example, the proliferation of insecure devices, the blur of the physical and the personal and professional lives, the blur of physical also and digital is another trend. And then the third trend is the weaponization of the internet. All of these trends basically are raising new challenges for companies. So we came up with this concept of a self-sustaining enterprise, where self-sustaining here refers to sustaining the business itself, but also being resilient about protecting that business and addressing security threats. And what we advocate for is really understanding and assessing trust in a different way in this new ecosystem. So when you're doing business in this environment and dealing with, you know, third parties, partners, vendors, et cetera, you can think of this as physically as your own neighborhood, and visitors are coming and leaving. So who do you trust in that neighborhood, right? If somebody knocks on your door, do you trust that person? Do you let them in? Do you ask them for credentials? What do you do? And similarly, when you have a business, right, you have all of these devices connecting to your network, whether they're personal or professional devices, meaning that they're owned by the company, do you trust those devices connecting to your network? What do you do if an insecure device tries to access some of your assets? But how do you assess how much you trust that device? We are encouraging our clients to think about trust-based authentication and assess that level of trust based on the identity that the device proclaims through its own attestation, based on the degree of control that the enterprise has over that device. So whether it's a corporate device or a third-party device, or it's a device owned by a person. And there are several factors that can help with that trust assessment, including what's the exposure to that unknown device, or if the unknown device is added to that neighborhood, can it be used to attack other devices? That could be used not only to assess that trust, but also to build a persistent identity for that device. And when you can track or have that persistent identity, then you can be more confident in the authentication decisions that you make for that device.
I see. All right. Interesting stuff as always. Malek Ben Salem, thanks for joining us.
Don't struggle to align your organization's cybersecurity with business risk. Get the only solution that goes beyond reacting to threats with vulnerability and risk monitoring. You need the next evolution of MDR, and only Critical Start delivers it. Critical Start doesn't just monitor and respond to threats. They put you in control by detecting suspicious activities, quickly responding to contain threats, and identifying your most critical assets and protecting them against vulnerabilities and exposures. With continuous visibility, expert guidance, and measurable risk reduction, Critical Start has redefined what it means to manage cyber risk. Demonstrate provable security maturity to your leadership while positioning your program to achieve the greatest risk reduction per dollar spent. Stop fearing risk and start managing it with Critical Start. Visit criticalstart.com and request a demo today. That's criticalstart.com.
My guest today is Dinah Davis. She's the director of R&D at Arctic Wolf Networks and founder of Code Like a Girl, an online community that aims to break down the perception that women aren't able to thrive in tech. She started Code Like a Girl in part out of frustration.
I was doing a lot of blogging about women in tech, and I couldn't find a publication that would take my work or that was really interested in it or fit. And as I was thinking about that, I was thinking, wow, right now the impact of me is just me, but what if it was the impact of all the voices of all the women in tech? And so I thought if I created a publication, I could bring all those voices together and then try to amplify them so more people would hear them, so the impact would be bigger. And so in January of 2016, I created a publication. And it took off. It was been a lot of work, hard work, but zero followers on day one, 2016. And today we have over 23,000 followers.
What is the typical types of things that we might expect to find on Code Like a Girl?
There's actually quite a large range. We have a technical section. There's people's experiences being a woman in tech. There is kid career advice. There's a whole section on getting kids involved in tech, especially young girls, and how to promote that. And we also have a focus on role models. So there's a whole page on articles about role models, because I think they're one of the key things to changing the view of women in tech and getting more girls and women involved in it.
But by day, you are director of R&D at Arctic Wolf Networks. So what was your experience like coming up in the tech world?
I mean, it was pretty typical. I remember being in a computer science class in my university, and my university was 7-1 women to men. It just happened to be a school where there was a lot of teachers and that kind of stuff, and we had a lot of women. But I walked into that computer science class, and there was 60 guys and 2 women, and I was one of the 2 women. So even in a university where it was completely flipped like that, the computer science was still dominated by men. So that has been pretty typical. I'm usually the only girl, one of the only girls on a team. And that hasn't bothered me terribly much. I wish that there was always more women there, but I just kind of, at the beginning of my career, just took it as it was. And then I had a really bad experience, and I decided that I didn't really want to stay quiet anymore. Early in my career, I was a little bit afraid of speaking up, that it might impact my career in a bad way. After that experience, I thought, I don't want other women to be going through this too. I'm not going to be quiet anymore. And if a company is not okay with me speaking up about these things, then I don't want to work there.
What kind of bad experience did you have?
Oh, I just had a terrible boss that was very misogynistic, and he was a bully. He was a bully to more than just me, but it really just wasn't fun. I didn't stay there very long, and I have since found much better employers, and Arctic Wolf is fantastic. I love working here. We have a female founder and a male founder. It gives a really awesome perspective. You have kind of a yin-yang situation there. Their personalities are different, so they complement each other. Plus, I'm working in security again, which I love, so.
There's certainly a shortage of women throughout tech and in cybersecurity specifically. We don't do a terribly good job of retaining women who do enter our community. And then even as things filter up, there are even fewer women up in the C-suite. First of all, what's the importance of having women represented at that level, and what can we do to improve the situation?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of studies out there that you can find that shows that if your C-suite or your board or your just generally your leadership team is more diverse, the company actually performs better. So really, it's there in the numbers and the money. And I just think different people from different backgrounds, different genders, give different perspectives, and you see more, so you can react better to changes in the market. You get more diversity of thought, both from, and it's not just women, it's like diversity of culture, background, gender, that's all important. But the more diversity you have there, the better you can react to when things change in the market. You have more ideas, more experiences to draw from than the single narrative that, you know, the older white male has.
And so what kinds of things do you think companies can do to better provide a good work environment for women and to retain them?
There's a fantastic article written recently on our blog, and it said, the woman said, "I don't want to feel like I'm a minority, but I want to be supported when I am." And for me, that like hit it right there. I don't want to feel like I'm somebody who's different. I just want to be treated the same as everyone else. But if there's a problem, I want to be supported. It's called "I'm a Woman in Tech, and This is What I Want in a Company" by Leah Mitchell. And she really describes it well. I have to hand it to her. She articulated what women in tech want, and I think what most minority groups want in tech.
So what do you credit with the success of Code Like a Girl? What do you think is the reason that it's resonated so well?
I think what resonates with them is that it's their stories. These are real stories. These aren't studies. These are things that people have experienced, or their advice from real people who are in the industry. You get to find out about role models and people you look up to, and they write about what they've learned and how they did things. To me, this has been about building a community to support other women in tech, and then using that community to raise awareness to people who are outside it.
That's Dinah Davis from Code Like a Girl. The website is code.likeagirl.io. And that's the CyberWire. We are proudly produced in Maryland by our talented team of editors and producers. I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening.